Janie Lee Grace. Welcome to the Natural Health and Sobriety Show on UK Health Radio. We are live.
Thanks everyone for coming.
From Hello Love. And I'm just so, so thrilled that my guest is Catherine Gray. Give her a round of applause. Thank you. Thank you. I mean, honestly, Catherine, it's hard to know where to start, really, because you have changed so many lives. So many lives. It's a thing, that, isn't it? It really is a thing. And, you know, for me, when I very first came across the unexpected joy of being sober, it took me a while to sort of stop spinning just from how sensational the title was, because that's it, isn't it? That is it. It is completely unexpected to find that sobriety is joyful. Yeah. It is not what anyone was expecting, right? With most of us, come to the point where we realize we need to quit, or we have to quit, or maybe we're even a bit curious, but it's always the fact that it's time and we have to stop. And if we don't, think it's going to go bad, and that's going to go bad, and this person will leave me, and this will happen, and God knows what I'll text, and on and on and on. And it's that pain that we have to get away from.
Yeah.
And we're not walking around going, oh, I'm looking forward to the joy, because no one's told us about the joy, you know, till now. And it was so magical. So thank you as a starter.
Thank you for saying that.
Tell us a little bit about, you know, let's wind it all back, because there might be people here or people listening who don't know much about your story.
Okay. All right, here goes.
I know you're an oversharer too, so I'm looking forward to it.
Oh my God, I'm definitely going to say things that I shouldn't say. Am I on, by the way?
We like that.
I am, okay.
Do you want to be turned up a bit?
No. Okay. So I just checking.
Can everyone hear all right?
Yeah. Okay, great. So I would say that my story started when I was about 27, when I started realizing that my drinking wasn't necessarily like my friends drinking, and started trying to moderate. And the reason for that was quite a dramatic story that I don't think anyone here will have a story like this. But when I was 27, I went to a work summer drinks party where all the drinks were free. And of course, I took full advantage of that. And I ended up getting arrested that night for being drunk and disorderly in Brixton, because I was just sort of stumbling around the streets. I couldn't remember where I lived. I mean, I'd only just moved there, but still, I should have remembered where I lived. And a police officer tried to help me, and I swore at her. I told her to F off. So they took me into the cells. I woke up the next morning, thought, where on earth am I? Is this just like a trendy, weird hotel?
It's like cell block.
Yeah, brutalist. And I was like, no, what has happened? I couldn't remember.
Just to pause you just for 1 second, I didn't ever black out, thank God, or have that experience. But
oh, wow.
I've heard people talk about this and how, well, you know, we say this thing, don't we? She wasn't herself when she was drinking.
Yeah.
I mean, really not. How terrifying to not be able to remember.
Yeah, I mean, I became like a detective, piecing together the night before from, okay, I've got this hand stamp and there's these texts that I apparently sent and, you know, I've got this coat that I don't recognise. Whose is that? And it became really, really scary. But most people experience what's called a brownout, where they just lose snatches.
Right.
So they might have a conversation with somebody and forget that. They don't lose like whole chunks of the night. So a lot of people start off having like brownouts. It's rare that people have total blackout like I did. But it certainly happens. And it's just you're at the point where your blood alcohol level is, you can walk and talk and appear normal and demand a kebab, but you are not really there. And your hippocampus isn't storing the memories. So,
isn't it crazy? And we do that and then we go and do it all again the next night.
I know. We just sort of limp through life, recovering and then doing it again.
But was that a proper wake-up call for you then?
Not really, Janie.
No.
So, I hadn't even got still to the best bit. So when I was checking out, or what do you call
checking
it?
Checking out. Paying the bill. Getting your bail.
When I was being released back into society, they said, oh, we're just going to go and get your things. And I was like, oh, that bloody time, you know, get my phone, keys and whatever. And he came back with this evidence bag, and the only thing in it was this dirty pink child's hairbrush that I'd never seen before in my life.
Wow.
And I was like, this isn't mine. What kind of place is this? I demanded a complaint form. I was like a Karen before Karens were a thing. And yeah, I just had to go home. Thankfully, my flatmate was there. I sort of figure it out. It was a work day, by the way.
Wow.
So I had to get myself together and go to work 2 hours late after a work party. So everyone knew why I was late and everyone else was hungover. And still, it didn't occur to me that I should stop drinking or even contemplate it. At that point, I was like, I really need to learn how to moderate. And then I started this like little golden notebook where I was counting up my drinks, trying to aim for under 30 units a week, because under 14 units seemed unthinkable.
Yeah.
I could clear that in a night. And writing all these rules for myself, like no free drinks parties, you must eat before you go out, you know, no drinking on these nights, rules, broke them all, bent them all, like amended them in the book. And that went on for years and years and years until, I finally realized, actually, maybe I shouldn't be drinking.
Yeah, at all. How about
that?
I mean, moderation is so exhausting. Exhausting and ridiculous, because it doesn't work. And why would you want it to work anyway when you realize that how joyful it is to be sober, right?
I mean, so moderation is defined as somebody who has 1 to 2 drinks per session, and that's it, they stop. And NHS now defines a binge as 6 units.
Right.
And I do not know anyone that moderates, if that is the definition of moderation. Not constantly.
No. Well, I always have this thing where it's a bit of a debate, isn't it? This word mindful drinking. You know, we talk about mindful drinking. And what I always say is, I think there are lots of people who are mindful drinkers. But they're mindful drinkers in the same way that I'm a mindful kiwi fruit eater. So I'm very happy to have a kiwi fruit.
Yeah.
And if there's 6, you know what, I might feel a little bit hungry, but then I won't have a kiwi fruit for another 6 months. Because it's not a thing for me. I don't need to read a book or join a club or get any help.
Yeah.
It's just not a thing. And there are people for whom alcohol is like that. It's not a thing. So yeah, they can have a drink and it's not a thing. They won't even think about it for a month if there's none offered.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean?
But if it's
a thing for you, it's addictive. And we become addicted to an addictive substance. And that's the bit people forget, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's like, oh, I must be have such an addictive personality. Well, no, it's an addictive substance.
Yeah. And I truly do think it is a thing for most people who drink. I mean, when I think of those people who do. So I find that, all right, there's only one person I can think of who has ever forgotten that I'm a non-drinker. Because for most drinkers, it's something that looms large in their mind about me because they drink, right? And depending on how attached they are to alcohol, that defines how large that is in their mind about that being the core of my identity.
Yeah.
And one of my friends, he, one Christmas, tried to give me some wine as a Christmas present. Yeah. I was like, Terry, what am I going to do with this? Like, what do you want me to do with it? Like, use it as a doorstop? He's like, oh my God,
I forgot.
Yeah. Because he truly is one of those people that, he might drink a few times a year and it really makes no difference. It's like the difference between having a lemonade and a Coke. It truly makes no difference to him whether he drinks or not. But he's really the only person that I can think of. Yeah. Because as you say, it's an addictive substance. Yeah. So it gets its hooks into everyone.
Exactly. And this is generally a thing, isn't it? You know, we don't have to wait till we get to rock bottom before we quit, right?
Yeah.
And because, as you say, you know, we have this unexpected joy. So when did you start to realise that there was joy involved?
Oh, very quickly.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, I did not expect it to be joyful whatsoever.
No.
I was truly like, oh my God, it's a death sentence.
Yeah.
You know, my social life is over. I'm never going to dance again.
Yeah.
I was very dramatic about it. I'm never going to go on a day or just be alone forever, just sit at home. You know, that's it for me. And what I found was, really quickly, sort of within the first few days, I started feeling good.
Yeah.
I mean, and very bad. You know, the first month,
it's a bit of a mix.
You know, if anyone's at the start, my gosh, it's rocky. Especially if you're physically addicted like I was.
Yeah.
And, you know, not even if you're physically addicted, the psychological withdrawal is savage as
well. Yeah, it's a roller coaster, isn't it?
Yeah. So, but I got these like brief but profound moments of euphoria.
Yeah.
And like, wow, I just feel so good right now. And, you know, it wasn't even when I was doing great things. Like sometimes I'd be in a dentist chair and be like, I feel amazing.
Well, I think it's that thing of, well, because I mean, you're sort of almost describing that sort of pink cloud euphoria, aren't you, in a way that people often get. But I think even when that passes, or even if you haven't got so much of that, it's more about contentment, actually, isn't it?
It's
that word contentment that, again, like joy, I had not associated with being sober. And in fact, that feeling of contentment, when I first got it, I actually didn't recognize the feeling, because I don't think I'd had that feeling of kind of contentment, you know, of a regular day, as it were, in the dentist, since I was a kid. Because you never do when you're drinking. It's relentless, isn't it? You're always either looking, you know, and drinking, or thinking about the next drink, or mopping up after the last one, or whatever. And I was always sort of, I suppose, on edge, really.
Yeah. And I mean, we know now why this is. So I don't know if any of you have listened to that Huberman podcast about
where he explains
how,
the,
you know, the cortisol science in people who drink, even if they only drink a little bit, is higher all the time. It's always slightly elevated.
Yeah.
And that makes sense to me, because I'm so much calmer now.
I know, yeah,
and
exactly.
Like, even when I was on my way here and I was like fighting my way through crowds on the tube, I was like, the way that I feel is like, it's like a core of peace.
Yeah, I love that, so true.
Nobody can take that from me, even when I'm having a bad day, even when it's chaos and I'm not being my best self or whatever, you know, I'm having a hard day parenting or whatever. I do feel like, and it was the opposite before.
Yeah.
The core was like a total maelstrom.
Chaotic.
It was, total, like the eye of the storm in there.
Yeah.
Even when I was pretending to be okay. So now I don't pretend to be okay anymore, for a start. Yeah. And it just feels so good for that to have flipped.
Totally. I know. That's exactly, I mean, you explain it really, really well. And I absolutely love that. So that's the thing that I'm always trying to get across to people, is this sense of balance that you can come back. It doesn't mean that all of life will be rainbows and bunnies and you will still have shit days, right? But you just, that, as you say, that at the core, you can have that sense of, well, it comes back to kind of knowing who you are, doesn't it? When you're able to step into that new identity. I mean, it takes a while, because at the beginning, you know, what the hell, I don't know what's going on. You're not even comfortable in your own skin. But over time, you settle in, don't you? So when you decided to write the book, and when you started to write the book, did you have any idea of the, you know, incredible success that you would have with that book? Could you even begin to imagine how incredible it was going to hit?
No, because one of the first agents that I met with told me that nobody was going to buy a book with sober in the title.
Right.
For a start.
Right.
She wanted me to write a completely different book. It was such a strange new idea that people didn't really get it. And I think, I mean, my publisher was really behind it, but I don't think they thought it was going to be, you know, take off the way it did. And it just so happens that the same time, you know, Claire Pooley was coming out with
Diaries,
and the One Year No Beer guys released a book as well. And
it was just the beginning, wasn't it, of the exciting period when the tide started to turn.
Yeah.
Yeah, amazing.
And it just caught on. But yeah, truly, I thought it was going to be, you know, my friends and family. And that was it.
So who here has read The Unexpected Joy of Being Sober?
Oh, wow.
Oh, wow. Lots of you.
That's amazing.
Who felt it changed their life? Yes, absolutely. Oh, wow. Right. Well, those of you who haven't read it, I mean, clearly that's the very first thing you do when you leave, isn't it? Try that.
UK Health Radio. The station that makes you feel good.
What if your healing journey could feel empowering, hopeful, even transformative? Welcome to the Alkaline Collective Mastermind, a community for anyone facing cancer, staying cancer-free, or committed to prevention. No matter your stage, whether you've chosen conventional care, an integrative path, or a fully holistic approach, here, you're not alone. Here, your healing journey becomes a journey of empowerment. We explore the science of oxygenation, metabolism, and alkalinity, while strengthening your emotional, spiritual, and physical well-being. This is a mastermind with heart, accountability, connection, wisdom, and real support. Because your journey isn't just about surviving, it's about thriving. Join us by clicking on the Alkaline Collective Mastermind banner on the UK Health Radio homepage or directly at alkaline-collective.com, where self-belief grows, healing deepens, and transformation begins.
Sarah wasn't bad at her job, she was stuck in hidden grief. After her dog died, she took a sales role just to stay busy, but every pitch felt empty. A Cogna Movement session uncovered that she was seeking the warmth of her dog rather than serving her clients. Using our patented movement and sensory patterns, she cleared the grief and rocketed to the top. What hidden emotion is holding you back? Try our Essentials program at the special UK Health Radio rate. Visit cognamovement.com/radio or click on the Cogna Movement banner on the UK Health Radio homepage. Results vary.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
That's not the only one, because then you also did a few more follow-on books, which we interviewed you on Radio 2, didn't we, for The Unexpected Joy of Being Single, mm-hmm. and The Unexpected Joy of the Ordinary, which, you know what, I still recommend that book to every single client, whatever stage they're at, The Unexpected Joy of the Ordinary. Yeah. Who's read it? I absolutely love that book. Oh. I love it because it just helps bring you back to remember, come back in control of little things, you know, and I think we chatted about it on Radio 2. You've just got these ridiculous lists in there of, like, you know, screwing up some paper and chucking it in the bin. And, you know, we can get a smile out of that, right? There's nothing else. You know? I just love it. I love the fact that, because when I was drinking, I could never have appreciated any little things, whatever the hell they are. Mm. It's just always bigger, better, faster, more. You know, don't tell me to appreciate a sunset or, you know, smell a rose or anything. For God's sake, give me the wine. You know? And that book's just so beautiful to bring you back to that balance. I love it.
Oh, thank you. Well, let me explain to everyone what the book is. So that was based on very early in sobriety. I joined a gratitude group, which at first I was like, this sounds way too American for me. It sounds way too Pollyanna. But I was willing to give it a shot because I was very aware that I am at... by nature, and still by nature, like quite a pessimistic, dry, deadpan, you know, I'm Irish, a Brit, I just lean that way. And I read this thing about how we all have negatively biased brains. And I was like, I definitely have one of those. So I was willing to give this sort of American notion, as I saw it, a chance, and started writing gratitudes every day. And it changed my life. It really did. And I still do it every night. And if I don't do it, I feel it. I remember when my daughter was born, I didn't do it for a while because we were like curling up and going to sleep together. And I got out of the habit of it. And I really started to feel negative and pessimistic again. So just it's about that.
Yeah, I love it. It's like a muscle, isn't it? You have to keep working it, the gratitude. Yeah. I call it writing blessings. It's the same thing. But certainly with people who are in the early days of sobriety, actually just noting down the little blessings that have come about because you're sober.
Yeah.
And they can be tiny things. It wouldn't mean anything to anyone else.
Yeah.
But it's really like building up that kind of unconscious library in your mind of all the good stuff linked to sobriety.
Yeah.
So that, you know, when the wine witch comes calling, you've got that whole library full of positive associations.
Yeah. And there's that great quote that it's something like the brain is like Velcro for the bad stuff.
Yeah.
And Teflon for the good stuff. Yeah. And that's so true. I mean, even to the point where if I put up a post on socials and I get 99 amazingly beautiful comments and I just get one negative comment, I will focus
right back to that person
so hard on that comment. And I mean, we all do this. You know, we can have a largely really good day and one negative encounter on the commute home, you know, like somebody cuts us up. And our minds just grab onto it because it's just how we're wired. It's a part of how we're wired to survive, you know, to look for threat. And
totally.
It's just, yeah.
But I love that in your writing, you know, you have this kind of thread that goes through all of your books, I think, that where, you know, you've got this sense of joy and obviously you're sharing all of this very well-researched stuff, because, you know, that's the other thing that you do is you work hard. You know, it's not just a bit of old fluff. You put an awful lot of effort in, I know. But there's also this kind of layer of vulnerability in there. So was that a conscious decision? You know, I am going to include the vulnerable bits of me.
Do you know what? I don't even know another way to be. It's just how I am. I've always been like that. Only when I was drinking, I told a lot of lies.
Yeah.
And I think maybe played the victim a lot and was vulnerable in that way. But I just can't help it. I'm just an oversharer. And I have to hold back. And one of my best friends read an early draft of Sober and she said, Kath, it's really great that you're being so honest right now, but maybe just take 10% off the top. So I did. Yeah. So that's not the whole truth.
But also, actually, yeah, in that book, I've literally just remembered, wasn't it in that book or was it in the Sunshine Warm book where you asked your friends to write
a letter? Yes,
you actually asked your friends to write a letter to the old version of you.
Yeah, but also the new version of me. I was just like, write.
I mean, that's very brave.
Exactly what you think about me. Don't hold back.
Yeah, being sober makes you brave, right? Let's ask our friends what they really think of us. Oh dear.
Yeah, thankfully. I mean, that I did brace myself for that. But yeah, I was just at that point where I was like, I am ready to hear this.
Yeah.
You know, and thankfully it was like, drunk Kath bad, sober Kath. Sober Kath good.
Yeah.
But you know, it was more nuanced than that as well. Yeah. So, but I think all of us could do with a bit of, you know, bracing feedback like that every now and then.
Well, it's true, isn't it? People have this kind of hankering to, oh, you know, wasn't it fun when I was drinking? And well, not really, actually. Most people, if they'd seen a video of themselves, would realize that actually it wasn't fun at all. You think you look amazing on the dance floor, but actually just like a complete brat, really. Yeah. And I've actually never met anyone who prefers themselves drunk.
No.
Not when they actually really look at it, you know.
No,
I think that's true. But being sober definitely makes you brave. That's a really good lead-in to your fabulous novel that I absolutely loved, Versions of a Girl.
Oh, thank you.
Anybody else read it? Oh, God, that's your second bit of homework. If not, okay. That's your second
bit
of homework.
Nobody has to read my books.
No, you do. You do. You absolutely do. Oh, man, I love that book. Can you describe, you can't really say what it's about because it's such a unique concept. But I actually don't know how you got your head around it.
I think one of the reasons I was intrigued by it is because when I was 10, my parents divorced and I moved from Northern Ireland to England with my mum, and so was primarily raised by my mother. And I always wondered what would it have been like had I stayed in Ireland and been more definitively shaped by my father, not just spent holidays with him. And so that was the sort of germ of the idea. And also I was pregnant when I was writing it, so I was very interested in nature versus nature and, you know, how our parenting can shape us and what we inherit and what is created. And so it's exploring that, basically. It's one girl and the story splits off and it's like a sliding doors concept where one version of her is predominantly raised by her mother and one version of her by her father, and just seeing how she turns out differently but also the same.
Yeah, I mean, it's amazing. And there are some really fascinating themes in there, not least alcohol, of course.
Of course.
You know, was it very, I mean, it must be very different to, how did you go about writing a novel when you'd been writing nonfiction?
It's a lot harder to write a novel. Don't know that anyone's tried to write a short story.
I've tried to write a novel and it just sits in the bedroom drawer. That's how brave I am, not. Because I found it, you know, even though I've written a ton of nonfiction books, I found it really, really difficult. And I still have got no idea whether it's any good. So I'm just assuming it isn't. And I daren't put it out.
Yeah.
So there you go. So well done you.
Oh, thank you. But yeah, I really did. I thought it was going to be a doddle. Yeah. I was like, I'm just going to make stuff up. It's easy. And then quickly discovered, you know, I mean, my background is in journalism, so I'm just used to writing nonfiction and interviewing experts and writing about my experiences and then widening it out to the cultural context. But yeah, sort of finding truth in fiction. But I think that's something that's true of all good fiction. There is truth at the heart of it. You know, Virgins of a Girl is in no way autobiographical. I have to say that for legal reasons. But, there are parts of it that are true in, you know, that they're profound, like life message and experience. So, yeah.
And I suppose you're able to explore themes that you obviously wouldn't in nonfiction.
Yeah.
Yeah. Very exciting. I love it. So we have to talk about the new book, Little Addictions, Freedom from Our Tiny but Mighty Compulsions. What a lovely strap line.
Thank you.
Tell us a little bit about the idea behind this new book.
Okay, so I don't know whether anyone will relate to this, but my big addictions have been put to bed. So quit drinking 12 years ago, quit smoking 11 years ago, took that year off dating 11 years ago to sort of put paid to my love addiction. And, you know, a few things after that, I loved debt, so I quit that. Loved being in my overdraft, quit that. And doom scrolling, that sort of thing. But what I'm still finding, so it's like a Russian doll, except mine is a giant Russian doll, apparently. And the biggest doll was the alcohol. But as I crack one open, there's another one and another one and another one. So what I'm finding is I'm still left with these little dolls of things.
So all
that
these different layers of yourself that you're still shedding, as it were. Is it that you're being made to look at them, do you think?
Yeah, I'm having to crack them open, you know. And with the bigger addictions, with clinical addictions, I'm just using that as a euphemism for you know, any sort of psychological or physical addiction. It's a no-brainer usually to go for abstinence. But with these smaller things that I do, you know, it's not necessarily something that I'm going to quit. So how do I moderate? Because I have no idea how to moderate anything. I'm very much a go hard or go home kind of person. Like, if I like something like chewing gum or mint tea or TV or sugar, or, you know, I'm just like, wow, give it all to me. I'm just going to have it all. And so I wanted to know, how can we live our lives in the most intentional way? So I've covered the things that are the most common addictions and talked about how to, you know, tame them down.
So give us some examples of what you were able to do.
Obviously, there's people that aren't necessarily going to quit alcohol. So there's what's called the sticky eight. So there's alcohol, nicotine, cannabis. Then there's porn, gambling, gaming, and our phones, and ultra-processed food. So they're the most addictive. So they're like the sticky eight. And then there's things like behavioral compulsions, like people pleasing, procrastinating, judgment and gossip, because judgment is addictive. We get a neuroscientific buzz from it. And as soon as I learned that, I never thought about it the same way again. Because when we place ourselves as superior to someone else, we get a reward in the brain.
Yeah.
Let me see if I can remember the others. Shopping, caffeine, TV, and dating, flirting, and sex. So there's 15 in total, but there's also loads of chapters in the book that are just universal about all addictions and all addictive behavior, and the overarching, you know, themes of them and what we can do. That I spoke to 5 neuroscientists because I love a bit of neuroscience. So there's a lot in there about dopamine and the prefrontal cortex and how it's the secret superpower against any kind of addiction. And yeah, I just loved it because it let me unleash my inner geek. I got to talk to 24 experts and go to labs and have my brain scanned.
Oh, did you? Amazing.
Yeah, there was a lot of out and about. I went to a rehab, spent 48 hours there. I just got to grill some of the brightest minds, learn about the cutting edge research. And yeah, it just was a dream come true for me.
What was the overriding thing that you learned from all of that research?
Oh, I can't condense it.
Come on. Well, what piece, if you like, did you put into place for yourself?
so much, Janie. So I now do something, because dopamine, I don't know whether anybody knows about dopamine, but dopamine detoxing and dopamine fasting makes no sense, because dopamine is a naturally occurring brain chemical which gets us to do anything. So the reason you got up in the morning was dopamine. The reason you got dressed was dopamine. The reason we do anything good and anything bad is dopamine. It's basically motivation. It's something that gets us to do something. So dopamine fasting is like this TikTok thing that makes no sense. So I write about dopamine shifting, and that's become like a really core part of my life now. Right. So I now know when I'm reaching for sources of fast dopamine, and I make sure I reach for enough sources of slow dopamine, because that sustains you. It doesn't drag you into a deficit afterwards. Has anyone read Dopamine Nation? So yeah, it's like an extension of that. It's like a practical way to actually use that knowledge.
So as you say, it's about being intentional then, isn't it? So you need to know in advance what your resources are, or what it is you're going to reach for, or whatever, I suppose.
Yeah, and also there's reasons, because I'm ADHD, and there's reasons why some people find that they crave like fast dopamine more. And one of the reasons for that is dopamine differences that people with neurodiversities experience. And so fast dopamine is more compelling to them. So one of the things that I discovered when I was writing the book is that I quit smoking 11 years ago, but I've been addicted to nicotine ever since. And I've only just now quit that because I realized, oh my gosh, you know, that's actually a medium to big addiction for me. You know, I'm having it every day. I quit
when I was pregnant. What, you mean patches or something? Or?
No, lozenges. Oh, I'm the only one who got addicted to lozenges. Everyone else waits. Oh, did you? Oh, so addictive, aren't they? And then I had to go on the patches to get off the lozenges. But yeah.
So talk us how you worked through that one then.
So I, for a start, I did a lot of reframing. So when I researched it for the book, I was really shocked by what I found. I thought nicotine was actually pretty innocuous. I'd placed it next door to maybe caffeine. I was like, it's a stimulant, but it's not really that bad for us. Oh no, it's really, really bad. So I was very shocked, and I think people don't realize how bad it is. Then I couldn't get away from it. I was like, I have to do something about this. Then I set a clock on it. I texted one of my best friends, said, in 3 months' time, I need to quit my nicotine lozenges. And if I don't do that, I'm going to give you a month's disposable income. You know, I'm going to give you £300. And so that, I'm competitive as well. So that tweaked my competitive urge. And then I started preparing for it. And much like we do when we quit anything.
Yeah.
You know, we there's always like a prep runway. And I always say that the quitting starts before the quit, because it really does.
Yeah,
like even
absolutely.
When you're still drinking or smoking or whatever, you start reading about it and mentally preparing for it.
But
I mean, I've noticed that I do feel quite flat without the nicotine. I feel calm. But it's that dopamine. I think I was using it as like a Ritalin almost, because it's a stimulant.
Right.
So
did you replace it with something?
No. I very consciously haven't done that because I know that I might find that very sticky.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, that was the only thing that I quit, though. There's lots of other things that I've successfully moderated down, like my phone and TV. And
tell us about the phone then, because of course that's, you know, a massive one for us all, isn't it? And I think that's increased massively in recent years. Would you agree?
Absolutely. And it's no great surprise if you try and go without your phone even for an hour. You know, I usually leave it downstairs and then go upstairs and work, and then you'll need your phone for some authenticated
Absolutely.
Like they're making it so you can't not have it.
That's exactly true. You can't, we were saying the other day, you can't park your car.
Yeah.
You know, literally you cannot park your car without your goddamn phone.
Yeah.
I can't forget where we were the other day where we were saying one of our friends who's quite elderly, you know, bless her heart, does not have a smartphone. Very sensible if you ask me.
Wow.
But I can't remember where we were. We were saying she wouldn't actually be able to be here.
Yeah.
Because she physically can't get in without a phone.
Yeah, you need you need it for tickets, you need it for parking, you need it for everything. Banking, work, like every single thing.
So what, how can we, you know, moderate, in inverted commas, that then? Because as you say, we can't completely detox from it.
No. And I mean, there's lots of things. There's, I think there's like 12 tips in the book, but the things that have really worked for me. So I love my music. I turned an old iPhone 7 into basically an iPod. So great. Downloaded loads of music onto that. And now I take that if I go for a run. Or if I'm, you know, out with my dog or whatever, I will take that so that I'm not constantly on my phone, so that I've got the music. And also I have like what's called a symbolic storehold. Like when I'm home and I'm with my daughter, I will put my phone behind one of her cuddly toys, like this Care Bear.
Yeah, yeah.
And if I have to move it, I'm like, I'm prioritizing my phone over my family.
Well,
right,
it's how we used to be when we were drinking, of course. And yeah, those of us that, you know, weren't bright enough to stop when the kids were young. I mean, literally used to stop reading a bedtime story to go and have a glass of wine.
Yeah.
You know, which is literally what was happening.
Yeah.
So, you know, you're right. The association is really strong.
But I could feel that scratch with my phone.
Yeah.
Like even if I left it in the kitchen.
Yeah.
And I was with my daughter, I'd be like, I'm just going to go. Because yeah, I would feel that urge to check. And one of the things that I found out about when I was researching the book is a couple of the psychologists said to me, it's about discomfort. So we think about checking our phone as like indulgence, but it's discomfort because we now find out via this one conduit whether, like, I found out that my granddad was dead via a text message. You know, we find out if we get the job and our lives are going to change forever.
Yeah.
And financial.
So it's a sort of fear of missing out. What is it we're missing out on as well?
It's not just that. It's the not knowing. It's it's the discomfort of not knowing what's in there and whether it could be devastating or a new nephew.
Yeah.
You know, it could be the most beautiful thing or the most devastating thing.
Yeah.
And it's all coming through this one device. So actually, it's a wonder that we're not more obsessed, you know? So I think it's important to sort of forgive ourselves for that because we don't have landlines anymore, most of us. We do get everything through this device and just find ways that work for us and remembering that. But the only way you can find it out is by doing it. Is that the sky won't fall in if you don't check it.
No, absolutely. And I think, you know, certainly for the next, you know, for your little girl, you know, I mean, what is going to happen? We have to keep old traditions, don't we? I remember reading something in the paper the other day about four and five-year-olds arriving at school and not understanding what books were.
Yeah,
because
trying to scroll.
Yeah, it's really sad. How sad is that?
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
A cancer diagnosis can be scary and stressful for everyone involved. Hello Love is a contemporary living space and well-being center in central London where anyone can come and learn about illness prevention and non-toxic practice. Inside, you will find a vegan restaurant, juice bar, and holistic dojo that encourage lifestyle changes to help heal mind, body, and spirit connection. Cancer patients are offered free sessions. To find out more, please visit us at hellolove.org.
Imagine. Every day, clients walk into your office with their concerns about intimacy, identity, desire, and trauma. Questions that require more than basic training. Emotional and sexual dynamics are evolving, and today's professionals must evolve with them. We hear from parents unable to start conversations with their children around identity. Too often, adolescents have learned their sexual ideas from the internet. Couples have difficulty communicating about sex with each other. At the International Institute of Clinical Sexology, you can gain the specialized skills and knowledge to address those issues with confidence. Whether you are a therapist, coach, educator, or other healthcare professional, our advanced certifications and PhD program empower you to become a highly skilled, sought-after sex therapist. Expand your expertise Elevate your earning potential. Start your journey today with the International Institute of Clinical Sexology. Imagine making a difference in our world. Learn more at clinicalsexologyphd.org.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
Yeah. I mean, I definitely don't want to live in a world without books. I don't even like ebooks. Don't give me a Kindle, and, you know, definitely not. I like a book. So, yeah, it is a bit scary.
It is scary. So, and it's not about to, I mean, obviously there's a lot of landmark trials right now with Meta, and, you know, they're being held to account for creating things that addict young people.
Yeah.
And I do think we are going to see a social media ban for under 16s. I do think a lot of changes are going to be made to help us when we're like guiding our kids through this. But for us, it's still going to be really addictive. So yeah. It's all about getting on our own sides, because nobody else is going to do it for us. They're not going to make it less addictive for us.
True. Yeah. Anything else you'd like to share about this new book that you know, that you hope people will kind of take away from it?
Yeah. So something else that I want to talk about is people pleasing.
Yeah. Because... Oh, yes. And does that resonate with anyone at all?
Yeah. Quite a lot. Yeah. And one of the things that I found out about when I was researching the people pleasing chapter. So everyone knows about fight, flight, freeze, yeah, pretty much. But people pleasing is fawn.
Fawn,
it's the,
yes.
You know, unknown, largely fourth sibling of the survival mode family. And so one of the reasons people pleasing is so hard to stop doing is because 100 years ago, just, it would have been absolutely disastrous for us to be excommunicated by our community.
Yeah.
And so no wonder we feel physical discomfort.
Yeah.
I mean, I have literally sent texts before and then like slid down the wall going, oh my God.
Yeah.
Because I'm saying no.
Well, we were talking about setting boundaries when we did another interview, didn't we? We were saying that for both of us, it's like setting boundaries. It's like, that you're so mean if you've said no. How dare you? I know exactly what you mean.
Absolutely.
It's like, oh, I've said no. Oh.
It's really hard to get out of that pattern. And it's about understanding why we feel that urgent need, especially to please family.
Yeah.
That's where it comes in the most strongly. So, yeah, I just wanted to share that with everyone.
It's a really important point. And I've had several clients who work with me one-to-one, and it's the main reason they're finding it almost impossible to quit alcohol, or they have in the past.
Yeah.
Because they're such people pleasers. They've got families who expect them to drink.
Yeah.
And they're good on their own. You know, they're absolutely good. In fact, I've had people say to me, actually, you know, I was doing really, really well. I didn't even desire a drink, really. I wasn't bothered at all. But when I went out with my friends and she plonked this, you know, vodka and Coke or whatever it is in front of me, and I, you know, and then she was taking a photo, and I thought, oh, you know, I'm thinking to myself, well, you could just have the Coke. The photo will look the same, right?
Yeah.
But so many people have got this ingrained sense that they need to do what the other person wants them to do. I mean, how can it possibly make any difference what you put in your mouth?
I know.
It can't make any difference, can it, right? But we are such people pleasers, and you're absolutely right. It's a fascinating topic.
Yeah.
So what do we do then?
You know, where people
how do we get past
like,
it?
Yeah, it does still happen where people are like, it's my engagement party.
Yeah, exactly.
It's Christmas. It's my birthday. You have to have a drink.
Yeah.
That does still happen. Although I hope it is ebbing away.
Yeah.
You know, I'm trying to spread the message that it's deeply uncool.
Yeah,
so
exactly.
So that it really is. Start doing it.
It really is, isn't it? I mean, you wouldn't do that if someone was a vegan.
No.
You would not say, you know, well, I'm having a barbecue and therefore you must eat meat. You know, just it's wouldn't make any sense, would it? And even if somebody did say that to you, just, yeah, go on, love. You know, you're good.
Yeah.
But we get into this thing of, oh, if they're putting that in their mouth, I'll have to put it in mine.
Yeah.
It's crazy, but it's really interesting, as you say, that it goes a long way back.
Yeah.
And I think, I mean, so how do we overcome it?
Well, one of the experts that I spoke to, he's an expert in the amygdala. And ultimately, when you are uncomfortable, it's usually that the amygdala is open.
Yeah.
And he said the only way to teach it, it's similar to the phone thing. He said the only way through is through. The only way to teach the amygdala that you are still safe and you are not going to die if you displease your family or friends is by doing it and seeing. And also somebody else said to me, look for the ratios. And I really knew what she meant, because when I started my era of people displeasing, which I went a bit far. And
100-day challenge for everyone.
Just displease all
everyone.
The people. Yeah, just say no to everything. I did go a bit too far and I said no to too many things. And I was like, I need to walk this back. Like, I've become a bit no trigger happy. And she said, the psychotherapist that I spoke to was like, you will find that the people who are the healthiest, like emotionally healthiest, when you say no to them, they're like, okay.
Yeah.
Whereas the people that really push on your no, you know, they try and pressure you to do
that.
What you want them
exactly
to.
Exactly that. You're shining a light on them, really, aren't you? Which is what always happens when people are drink who want you to drink.
Absolutely. Yeah. So in a way, it's like sorting out, you know, the most emotionally healthy people, usually the people that have good boundaries themselves, who respect other people's boundaries.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I love that. Yeah, I remember that conversation that you and I had about boundaries, because it is something I think that comes with sobriety, isn't it? As you often, for people who have found it hard, as you settle into sobriety, you're able to just recognize, you know, it's going to be okay to say no.
Yeah.
You don't actually have to rock up to that event if you don't want to.
Exactly.
And if you just want to go to bed at 9 o'clock, you know, you're still a rock star, right?
Absolutely.
You know, once you quit alcohol, you realize how much of it is in movies, don't you? That you hadn't even, it's like, what the hell? I mean, we now realize it's all product placement anyway. It's all seeding messages anyway. But it's almost like you can't watch anything without, there's always constantly alcohol in there. There's either alcohol in there or there is someone who is, you know, an absolute alcoholic, complete alcoholic.
Yeah, usually a detective.
Yeah, and exactly. But if there's an alcoholic in there, there's usually that sense of, oh, thank God I'm not that bad.
Yeah.
So then you can brush past that bit.
Yeah.
But usually the alcohol is there and it's all seeded in and it's all celebratory. I remember watching The Greatest Showman not long after I'd quit, which, you know, I love that movie and I love the music and everything, but what is that drinking scene? For God's sake. I mean, Unnecessary does not cover it.
Oh,
I don't know if you've even seen it.
No,
but
I haven't.
Really, you know, I wouldn't have even noticed it before I'd quit alcohol. Wouldn't have noticed it. And yet loads of kids watching that movie.
Yeah.
And you're just seeding, you know, oh, everything starts to go well. And now we absolutely hammer it.
Yeah.
And it's like that in everything, I suppose.
Yeah. It's often the case in like any coming of age movie. Yeah. It's where the sort of awkward, geeky teenager goes to the party and starts doing some shots. That's when it starts going well for them. And you're like, that was kind of the opposite for me.
Yeah. So that's amazingly exciting. Thank you for sharing that with us. And I really hope that comes off. That would just be amazing. Catherine Gray, thank you so much.
Thank you for being such a lovely crowd.
Thank you for coming. And we'll see you on the next one.
You've been listening to the Natural Health and Sobriety Show on UK Health Radio.